You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week. So we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore and welcome to the second and concluding part of the discussion between Jeroen Swart and Ross Tucker, the two South African sports scientists in Cape Town. Hosted by Lionel Burney for the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
You've been very outspoken on Twitter over a number of years about Chris Froome and Team Sky, and you've made comments about, you know, some of the supposed or so-called marginal gains that Team Sky have employed. Aren't some of these details the sorts of things that in the era that follows the kind of industrial EPO era, if we can call it that, aren't these little details the sorts of things that clean athletes now have to focus on, whereas perhaps in the past they didn't have to because the EPO gave such a significant performance benefit?
Again, to repeat the same thing we've spoken about, is that context matters a great deal. So no one is saying that the data, the performance, the physiology or anything is ever going to prove a case for or against doping all by itself. I'm mistrusting of cycling. I don't see that there's been change from many different areas or in many different areas or from many different levels. So I think there's a skepticism about cycling, which now also exists for, say, track and field, if not even more so, based on what's emerged in the last month. So, of course, anything is going to be looked at through a slightly skeptical lens, and that's something I would be happy to start by saying I'm skeptical. Then I hear explanations like marginal gains and so forth, and I think, well, is there only one team using them, and did they not use them in the past? Let's not forget that Armstrong and US Postal were famous for being micro-detail management-oriented. I mean, he used to call himself, he said his nickname was Mr. Millimeter because everything mattered so much that it was so precise. So were they dropping balls just because they could get away with EPO? No, because in a competitive space, everyone was doing the minimal stuff as well. Or everyone was doping. And so therefore, the advantage was still going to come from doing something no one else could do or doing it better, right? So I don't believe that in a competitive space, at the top end of sport, that people are going to drop the obvious balls just because they're using doping. Because some of the stuff we've been told just doesn't sit with me. It sounds like I'm being rolled a line. It's a PR thing, and that's one of my reasons for skepticism. And I'm happy to say that because I don't see myself working in cycling anytime soon. But I'm just mistrusting of the kind of explanations that we hear. I mean, it's a difficult, I suppose, a bind to put them in. I've worked with certain high-performance teams, and everyone buys into this idea of marginal gains. I traveled for 4 years on the World 7 Series, and I can assure you that we thought we were super innovative until we learned what every single other country was doing, and it was the same stuff. So I'm honestly not a believer that there's a gain when everyone is doing it. You can improve within yourself, but in a competitive space, when it's truly competitive, I'm not a big fan of those explanations. However, I will say that everything Jeroen's spoken about, the tactics, the weight loss, the treatment of Bilharzia, a little bit of experience and age, maybe a bit of racing wisdom, these are all plausible explanations for why Froome went from being where he was to where he is. And that's why no one is saying this proves that Froome definitely doped. It's just a series in an ongoing conversation that consists of questions that have to be asked. If these questions had been asked by more people in 1994-95, in 1999, we might have gotten to answers quicker then too.
Yeah, look, Ross, I think you definitely make a valid point there in terms of, you know, the history of the sport and the skepticism that comes with that. And I hear what you're saying on Team Sky as well. I mean, I've said it in the past as well. I think they could have done a better job in terms of the PR around all of these questions. Mm. I think Chris has done a fairly good job in terms of that. Team Sky, I'm hesitant to say they've done a good job in terms of the PR. I think Dave Brailsford could certainly be a lot more open with the media. He seems to be quite irritated when they ask certain questions and reluctant to actually engage on them. You can't do that in this day and age. With the history of the sport that we've had, you can't say no comment, and I'm not prepared to discuss that topic. I think you've got to be open about it and be honest and open about it. Internally, you know, I hear they're a particularly open team and there's lots of internal discussion and transparency. From a media perspective and from the outside, I think it creates the wrong impression when you have those kinds of responses. So, you know, valid point. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to a point where we can have data being openly shared and without anybody jumping on particular points and coming to conclusions without a due process.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to rank my skepticism, it would be cycling. I'm super skeptical of cycling. Like, when you see what Team Astana went through over the last 2 years, and they had how many guys? Four guys, I think, in the space of a few months, failed doping controls, and their license was up for renewal and so on. And then you want to tell me the best guy on that team is the only one not doping? Like, okay, great. In a vacuum, maybe I would believe you, but in the history of cycling, like, I'm afraid I'm not buying that. And you look at other teams, and you just see what's happening. So cycling is at my number one on the chart of skepticism. And then there's Sky. Now, do some of the European teams say the same sort of stuff? Maybe they do. But I don't speak Spanish or Belgian or German or Dutch, so I'm afraid I can't comment on what they say or don't say. And then the problem is that Froome is part of Sky, which is part of cycling, and he's also, by virtue of the fact that he's wearing a yellow jersey, asking people to believe that he's the first guy in 25 years who's gotten there without doping. So you can understand why there is skepticism. It's not the same thing as being judgmental and judging the guy. It's just that there's so much skepticism that cycling has cultivated for itself, and Sky have not done much to get rid of. I mean, I think back to Wiggins when he won the Tour at that press conference, and anyone who asked questions were bone idle, and I don't know if I can say the word for your podcast, but you know which word it was. And the aggression that comes out, and maybe Chris Froome's been good, but Mrs. Froome, Michelle Cowan /Froome, has not been. And when you start attacking people who ask questions, they say, oh, we've seen this before, and again, where? Because of Lance Armstrong. So you're back at the same situation where they have created a comparison to Lance Armstrong. And it's silly. Like, just honestly, open transparency and less defensiveness. It's easy to say, I know, but that would go a long way for some people to winning the perceptual battle.
Well, I was in that press conference where Bradley Wiggins said that word that we can't say on the podcast. And I'm trying to think, it was the second day he was in the yellow jersey. You know, it was the second press conference that was dominated by that line of questioning. He certainly snapped. But I mean, if you were a clean athlete, I'm not coming down on one side or the other, but how would you as a human being react in those circumstances? I think I'd feel pretty aggrieved if, you know, the whole baggage of the history of the sport does seem to rest on the shoulders of the yellow jersey, particularly when that yellow jersey has got a Sky logo on the front. But when you talk about, you know, the perception of an entire sport, and I worked through and watched this whole era. You know, 1999 was the first Tour de France that I spent any time working on as a journalist, and I was as green as the grass, as they would say over in Ireland at that time. And I went on a learning curve that took a number of years. There was at times a real sense of sort of demoralization that everywhere you sort of went, you just found doping existing in every team. And just from having been around long enough, I feel like there is a different atmosphere around not just Sky, but almost all of the teams. There is a greater level of openness. You know, there aren't so many sort of averted gazes. There isn't the same atmosphere around at the Tour de France that I can remember in 2006, 7, 8, when the doping scandals seemed to come on a weekly basis. But just on sort of judging what we see, I mean, Ross, if if I showed you a picture of a test rugby team from, I don't know, 1989 and a test rugby team from the recent World Cup and the different size of the human beings that are playing the sport now, I mean, it's like night and day. I could easily, and if there was any appetite for it in the mainstream media, we could easily draw the conclusion that the size of the rugby players has been created by performance enhancing big bulk up drugs. I mean, it looks like a sport that's gone through as dirty an era as professional cycling has, to me, as a lay sports fan in that case.
Yeah, and there is an appetite for that discussion, and that discussion was had quite widely in the media at the time of the Rugby World Cup. Number of papers carried things saying how dirty the sport is. Paul Kimmage, who's a name well known to cycling fans, has written articles and has interviewed and covered accusations of doping that date back to the 1980s in the French rugby team. He had a whistleblower who played on that team and said they were all on amphetamines before they played against the All Blacks. So there is without question a problem, and that's a question that has to be asked, and it is being asked, but it's not necessarily one that should replace the questions asked of cycling. It should be additive.
Absolutely not. But the thing is that as soon as a rider crosses the line in a Tour de France mountain stage, this is the only question from a large number of people, isn't it?
Yeah, but why is that? I would argue that's because people want to believe. And so you should actually be harnessing that, because I really don't believe that many of those, some of them, yes, but I think that many of those people who are asking those questions, they ask them because they want to believe. And maybe they've been so tarnished and so tainted. I think Antoine Vaillant is someone who's been so dismissed and disregarded, and he's been so, in effect, or what's the word, like when you're disillusioned at the sport, that he's become excessively cynical and he doesn't really help himself with his manner of debating it. I don't think it's totally worthless, but it doesn't help. But I still think that the issue is that people want to ask these questions because they actually want to believe. Now, there are people who don't, and like, whatever, man. If you're Chris Froome and any other cyclist, you just got to say there'll always be, in a subset of 100 people, there'll always be a group of them who you'll never win over. Just let them go. It's not worth your energy. But if I was that, to come back to what you asked in the very beginning, as a human, if I was asked those questions as opposed to a scientist, I would be furious. But I wouldn't be angry with the guy asking the question. I'd be furious at the people who've given me the legacy. And I just don't see enough of that from cycling in general. I don't see cyclists condemning doping. It's like they don't come down hard enough on it, in my opinion, to make me believe that they actually are that concerned. And when the athletics thing broke, there were certain athletes, Nick Willis, for example, who was absolutely outspoken against how the IAAF was running the sport and absolutely against doping. Other athletes have withdrawn themselves from nominations for Athlete of the Year in protest against dopers. Those are people that I'm more inclined to believe, because I would be absolutely furious, you're right. But to rather direct that anger to the people who gave you the legacy and the tarnished trophy that you now hold, as opposed to the guys asking the question, because they're not the enemy.
Right, let me jump in there, because that's been quite a long monologue that I'm going to respond to. So the first thing is, in terms of the response to questions about doping, I think certainly from Chris's side, I think he's been, and Brad Wiggins before that, have been particularly calm and open to answering those questions. I mean, in the Tour, every interview includes a section on doping, and I think to Chris's credit, he's been happy to answer those questions every single time. I think we saw a very different type of response in the Armstrong era, where those questions were dismissed and attacked, and I think that's a clear difference. And I think in terms of, if we look at the teams, yes, Sky could, as I said, they could do better with certain questions and the way they handle certain things. But I think the big difference between that and for instance, Postal Service, is we haven't had Neil Swart, Emma O'Reilly, Betsy Andreo, and a whole host of other people who've seen and heard things and witnessed testimony to shenanigans happening behind the scenes. There's been absolutely nothing about Sky. And in fact, the biggest critic, or second biggest, depending on whether you think Kimmage or David Walsh was the biggest critic, but certainly one of the biggest critics of Armstrong in the heyday of doping, you know, was embedded with Team Sky and has come back saying he can't see any evidence of any doping. And some people say, oh, well, that's because David Walsh has been paid off. That's a particularly skeptical way to look at it. The guy made a huge, decade-long effort to expose doping in the sport. And, would he really now nullify all of that by, you know, taking some bribe from a team to testify that they're actually clean and innocent. I mean, you know, that's really, really taking cynicism to the extreme. And just to comment on Michelle, and you know, yes, she is particularly emotional. I mean, she's Chris's manager, she's Chris's wife, so, you know, at some point I would also probably get emotional in that state and lash out. You know, maybe it's not the best way to do things, and maybe it gives the skeptics more ammunition, but it's understandable. So, you know, from my side, I'm skeptical about cycling because of the history, but I'm also optimistic in terms of a lot of the stuff that I've seen. Yes, there's still a lot to be done, and I think I take your point about the vilification of dopers. I think there should be a zero tolerance to doping in cycling, and teams like Astana that are still in the World Tour despite all of those positives. I'm disgusted by that. I think Astana should have had their license withdrawn, and they should have been, you know, to hell with the repercussions in terms of the staff and the effect it has on jobs. The damage to the sport is far greater keeping teams like that in the sport.
Exactly.
That team shouldn't be here. Simple. 100%. So, you know, I'm not blind to doping. I'm not blind to the effects of it. But I'm also very hopeful in terms of a lot of what I've seen. I'm sure we've got issues with Team Sky. I mean, the Lindis thing, you know, there wasn't due diligence attached to that hiring. And that really hurt them. I think it was a silly decision to hire him. I don't think the fallout from that was handled well, but that's one issue. And if you look back at the overall spectrum and the amount of, you know, positive signs coming out of Team Sky, I think they far outweigh any of the suspicious signs. And that really makes me hopeful for the future. I think the performances as well, yes, we've seen improvements in performances, but we've seen different ways that the guys have ridden. Since Sky took the stage, if you look at the way that Wiggins climbed those climbs, they were done at a constant power output. We never saw that in the past. I mean, if you go back to 2008 and you looked at, for instance, the Paris-Sword when Contador, Rasmussen, and Levi, it was 2007, yeah. Exactly. Rasmussen, Contador, and Leipheimer were attacking each other over and over again on the Paris-Sword. That kind of climbing, you know, where you're what we call in scientific terms stochastic efforts, where you're going really hard, really slow, really hard, really slow. That's not going to produce the same kind of performance as a constant effort. And so the way that people are riding on the climbs these days, that constant effort, is going to probably result in a better overall performance than if you're attacking each other relentlessly. We saw that in the Vuelta this year, in the first week, where Chris got dropped on one of the climbs, and all the other favorites were off the front. He kept a steady rhythm. And by the end of the stage, he passed everybody and ended up second on the stage. You know, that's riding scientifically. And I think there's a lot of merit in that in terms of the performances that we've seen. So, yes, maybe we're seeing performances that are maybe not on par with the doping era, but are certainly a lot better than we were seeing in 2008, 2009, when the passport first came into effect and we saw a drop in performances. So I think there's reasonable scientific explanation for the performance improvements that we're seeing, and you know, that, as I said, gives me hope, and hopefully we can keep doing more. And this is probably the start of a discussion in terms of what more needs to be done, and I think Ross and I probably have more in common than we disagree about.
By a lot. I mean, I'm also like, I'm not without hope, just because I'm skeptical. You can be skeptical and still have hope. And I'm on record as writing and saying that I believe that the sport is better than it was. Like, there's no doubt that I think fewer people are doping, and those who are doping less than they would have done. And that the biological passport, while perfect, is not completely useless. And so there is hope on both sides. And so, yeah, we agree on a lot more here. I just, from a strategic point of view, I don't think that doping from the sport, as I said, number one on my list, and from Sky, has been handled particularly well. And Froome, if he's an unfortunate victim or part of that, it doesn't matter. The questions are still there.
And for the next hour, we'll be moving on to athletics, where we've had a few issues.
Russian athletics, and then an hour after that, we'll talk about Kenyan athletics.
We should wrap it up. Just to pick up on something you mentioned there about Geert Leinders and Team Sky's kind of... it's interesting, you've mentioned a couple of times, Ross, you know, the PR aspect to this, I mean that was not a smart signing, and I think you're right to say they didn't do their due diligence on recruiting Dr. Leinders, given that he was the Rabobank team doctor in the years when Rabobank had a lot of doping problems. Michael Rasmussen famously ejected from the Tour de France whilst wearing the yellow jersey at Rabobank. But I mean, back in 2012, myself and Owen Slott from The Times were the only two journalists to sit down with Dave Brailsford and ask him about that recruitment decision. And I suppose it boils down to whether or not you believe that Sky would have hired Dr. Leinders, or indeed any of the other sports directors that have had brushes with doping in the past, whether they've been hired for their doping expertise or whether actually the team was capable of running a clean program with individuals who may have had a murky past. And I suppose Sky have been sort of hoisted by their own petard in the sense that they set out with this zero tolerance policy, which, when you think back to the origins of the team in 2009, looked like a wildly optimistic and impractical stance to have taken. So I do understand why that question comes up, but I think it's more to do with whether you think that the decisions have been made in order to get the entire Sky team on a doping program. And I think it boils down, as scientists, you know, you're straddling the kind of line between how things look and how things are, and I would always say surely the greatest evidence of doping is whether or not somebody is doping rather than what their specific performances are on the road.
So just an anecdote in terms of the what I would consider evidence to support Sky's clean policy is Jonathan Tiernan Locke. We clearly see that he was convicted of using using EPO in the time before signing with Team Sky. And I think if we look at his performances at the time that he was with Sky, and certainly in terms of his blood values, he went from a superb performance at the Tour of Britain and a reasonably good performance at World Championships to not performing at all. I think if Team Sky were so embedded in a doping culture, I think we probably would have seen the exact opposite or a maintenance of that. For him to drop completely off the radar in terms of his performances, and for the blood values when he was with Team Sky to have been the death knell in terms of his biological passport, that to me is quite reassuring.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think tactically and strategically, I'll tell you this for free, is that given the history, so when you talk about the perception is created by the market, which is cycling followers, and their perception owes a great deal of itself to the history of the sport. And if you are going to position yourself as being completely clean and everything's going to be above board and so on, then you cannot, under any circumstance, create opportunity for an ambiguous interpretation of what an action means. And that's what you're talking about, is people are going to look at the hiring of Leinders and say, oh, but he was hired not for his doping expertise, but for his other attributes, which were probably really good. It's the same. All those guys who were involved in the 90s and 2000s, they were probably outstanding physiologists, scientists, doctors, whatever their role was. But if you're going to make a decision or take an action and it creates any ambiguity, then whether by omission, i.e. you leave something out, or whether by saying something you shouldn't have, you're going to add fuel to the fire that you yourself have begun. So that's where strategically you just cannot afford inconsistencies, and those were what most people are picking up. And there's not just that one, there are a couple of others as well, and people are going to ask about them again. You've said a few times that you feel that as scientists we should be saying only evidence of doping is doping. Well, history disagrees, unfortunately, and doping control evolved from the 1980s and 90s, where it was very much smoking gun. We're going to test your urine, and if we find the drug, then you will be banned, and it's going to be really simple. Well, afraid not. What's the line from Wizard of Oz? We're not in Kansas anymore, right? True. And so that is not going to work. And if we hold on to that, we're just going to be spinning around the same orbit for many, many years. The whole anti-doping focus has to change, and if we don't continue to probe and ask questions and so forth, then it won't. So I'm quite comfortable scientifically talking about this, being what I think is balanced and transparent. And if people want to disagree, then like, you know, Jeroen and I, we disagree on one or two things, but we appreciate that those disagreements are not necessarily destructive.
I think just I should clarify what I meant by that. I mean, what I'm saying is that the only way to definitively say somebody is doping is if they are doping. It's only fair to call someone a doper if they are doping. It's not fair to insinuate doping based purely on performances we see on the road.
Yeah, I guess it's just, I think emotion dictates what's an insinuation and what's not in this particular discussion.
Well, let me comment on that from someone who works in the anti-doping field. And the thing is that we've moved a long way from the days of the analytical positive. So the analytical positive is, you know, we test your urine, we find a performance-enhancing substance, you're guilty. More and more often, we're moving to the non-analytical adverse findings. And that means that we're collecting data, and it's really becoming an exercise in sort of investigations conducted into the athletes, all the aspects of an athlete. So, you know, we're going to see that becoming a bigger and bigger part of the anti-doping work as time goes by, because it is so difficult to achieve an analytical positive, particularly for substances like EPO. There's still no assay out for growth hormone. We've been waiting for that for ages. The blood transfusions at this point in time, although there's some hope in terms of tests that are coming out in the near future, but at the moment, you know, you're taking out your own blood and putting it back in, you know, there's no analytical test for that. The biological passport helps us to spot athletes that are doing things improperly, and we collect other data around that. And the performance aspect is one variable that can be included in that. So, you know, there's definitely a scope for the assessment of performance. Putting all of that together with the biological passport, we look at everything from, you know, the athlete's entourage and various other components in producing a case against an athlete these days. And so, you know, Ross is correct. The days of the analytical positive are gone. And so there is a lot of merit in the ancillary data. And how we do that, I think, is really the next question is, you know, how do we go about that process?
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's what we need to answer.
Exactly. So it's much messier and more complex, but it's much more effective. And best example is a journalist from Germany goes to Russia and he finds whistleblowers, and 18 months later, okay, it shouldn't have taken that long because the authorities were slow to respond, but now we know exactly how dirty and rotten track and field was. If it hadn't been for that journalist, we'd be sitting here none the wiser. So those types of questions and people who are willing to probe what's happening, and let me be frank, if anyone who followed athletics, we knew there were issues coming out of Russia and we knew there were issues in Kenya. He was the guy who unlocked that, and now we're wiser. So I think we should be encouraging that sort of thing. And it's not the same as saying you are a doper. It's saying that there are questions about you which need to be answered. Let's look, and if we can't find anything, then one day we'll say, hey, you know, we did our best, and we couldn't find anything. So now,
yeah, the point is, though, that cycling was at the point athletics is at now, back in, you know, 2006, 7, 8, when the whole, you know, there's the Operation Puerto investigation. That was the period when cycling was in, you know, much more in the position that athletics is in now. And I would argue that, you know, the biological passport, which came in well, it was being developed in 2008, wasn't it? The first sort of adverse findings were in 2009. I mean, I would say, you know, purely anecdotally, that my impression is that was the greatest contributor towards a cultural change within the sport, and that actually the changes that you're talking about there actually are underway, and that we're not starting here in 2015, nearly 2016. Actually, we're 7 or 8 years into this process, and that you know, the Chris Froome has had now, how many years has he been with a World Tour team? He's had 5 or 6 years in which he could, you know, the opportunity to trip the biological passport system has existed. And, you know, any rider, I've got to be a little bit careful here how I phrase this, but, you know, if Chris Froome has sort of tripped the wire and been given a warning, then, you know, he's been... There's been plenty of opportunity, particularly during the periods where his performances have been, you know, extraordinary. The transformation in 2011, you would think that if the biological passport is the tool to detect athletes who are doping, there's the biggest red flag in performance is in that period, and there was no case brought against Chris Froome in the period where he made the greatest transformation, is the point I'm trying not very effectively
to make. No, I think you are, and I certainly... the fact that we both say that we believe that the sport has improved and we have reason for optimism is a reflection that what you're saying is accurate. I just don't know that it's as accurate as perhaps some people want to believe. I mean, in track and field again, you had, well, how many was it? 5,000 samples, of which 30-odd% were suspicious, and it seems that they weren't followed up, and so forth and so on. So I don't know that. I mean, the journalist from the BBC went on blood doped and then EPO use himself, and he managed to get it. And that's just a journalist who wanted to figure it out to write a story about it. So a professional athlete who wants to beat the passport can do it. It's the test. It's not an abject failure, but it's not the sort of silver bullet that's going to change everything. It's part of the culture shift, but it's not turned it on its head.
The biological passport has definitely put a ceiling on the extent that athletes can dope. So, it's cleaned the sport up tremendously. And we see that, Ross was talking earlier on about the Zorzoli data, before the EPO test came out, everybody had these really, really sky-high reticulocyte counts. The EPO test came out, they had really, really low reticulocyte counts. Biological passport came out, and now we're seeing very few abnormal reticulocyte counts. So it's put an... in the past, the UCI put an upper limit of 50 on the hematocrit. That, it put a ceiling on the amount of EPO that athletes could use. The biological passport has taken that to another level. So, and that, I think, is the most important factor. It's possible for a clean athlete to win now. In 1999 through to 2007, there was probably zero or very close to zero chance that you could win as a clean athlete. I'm talking about at the level of the Tour de France and international races. I think it's very possible now that as a clean athlete you can win. And that, I think, is the key difference, is that the possibility of being caught as a doper is so much higher now. We're never going to eradicate doping. There's always going to be an individual who's going to want to cheat to try and achieve success. The risk-reward ratio comes into that. The risk has got ever greater, and even this year, the increase from 2 to 4 year bans for using EPO or anabolic steroids and the possibility of having those extended increases the risk ever more. And so we can control doping. We'll never get rid of it. It's going to be a continuous battle. But I think at this point in time, the sport is cleaner than it's ever been. And I think that's really what you were pointing to, Lionel, and that we've come a long way. We still have to do more, and we've still got to continue the process to make sure that clean athletes have the best possible chance of competing and winning. And that means we've got to be continually moving forward in terms of the steps that we take to eradicate doping. The biological passport has been a phenomenal success, but we've got to actually still develop more and more effective tools as time goes by.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all agree that there's fewer cyclists doping less. That in fewer people, and those who are can get away with less. But is that enough? Well, no, because we can make fewer even fewer than that, and we can make less even lower than it is now. So that's, I don't think we're disagreeing necessarily, but if we stopped probing and stopped questioning things based on pattern recognition, which is kind of important, without necessarily accusing, then we would be going backwards again, I feel, because the drive to win, the reward that Ewan spoke about, is higher than it's ever been too. So if you relax one side of that equation, then the other side will overwhelm it.
I think also an important thing is, and what you brought up now, is accusing. I think there are individuals that are accusing Chris of cheating. They're vocal individuals who use the performances as justification and proof that he's cheating. And I think that's irresponsible. And I think you'd agree with me, Ross, that that's irresponsible to come out with and Veya is a classic example, and there are a few others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that creates the backlash, that you're talking about in terms of having an emotional response to that. Because if I was a clean athlete and being accused of cheating, certainly my blood would boil and I would want to lash out. But then if you jump on... If an athlete lashes out and then you say, well, look, it's the same thing, it makes it worse for them. So, it's a lose-lose situation in that scenario. And I think we've got to be responsible and move away from, you know, looking at performances and saying, you know, that's evidence of doping. That's definitely irresponsible. And I think in this hour plus discussion, we've given quite a lot of you know, merit to understanding the performances. But at the same time, we've got to continue to strive for a cleaner and cleaner sport as time goes by.
Can I, for me, like, you've got these two parties at opposite extremes, and the one we can call cheerleaders or fans or whatever it is, who I think are hopelessly naive and they want to believe. It was the same for Pistorius, it was the same for Lance Armstrong, except most of them are on the other side of the Atlantic. And on the other side, you've got this group of outrageous cynics and so on, and everyone's pulling in opposite directions. And so both of them are probably contributing a positive aspect to it, because if one of those groups didn't exist, the whole thing would be unbalanced. But the real balance exists in the middle. And the one interesting hypothetical I was thinking of earlier on is, imagine social media and Twitter had been around from 1998-99 when Lance started winning. The whole tenor of that conversation would have been quite interesting to sort of just imagine as a thought experiment. Where would it be? So social media has created these extremist opinions, and the responsible thing is to try and discern which of them needs to be taken into account and which of them should be dismissed, and find somewhere in the middle there will be an approach to this. And that's really all anyone is calling for. Now, if I was a cyclist, I would not waste my energy on people who I felt were super far extreme, but I would understand that there are things that I can do that might convince 10%, 50%, 90% of them that I'm more believable than what they've seen in the past that made them extremist. And that's what I'd be doing strategically and tactically. And science is part of, not all of, that.
I think Jeroen has made the point that with our hour-plus long discussion, I think we may have to wrap it up there, if that's okay with you guys, unless you've got any last words you particularly feel that you've not said so far.
Gee, I think we've covered pretty much everything in terms of the spectrum. So I think the key thing is to say, watch the space, and let's see where it develops from here.
Yeah, I agree. This whole scientific process is, you come up with a hypothesis, then you do everything you can to disprove it, right? So. Yeah. So let's see what doing everything involves. But you can't stop questioning, because then you're not doing everything.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
To paraphrase Ross Tucker at the end there, science has some but not all of the answers, which seemed like an appropriate place to stop or pause the discussion between Ross and Jeroen Swart. Hope you enjoyed eavesdropping on their chat, and we'd like to say a big thank you to them both for allowing us to listen in. What's clear is that they don't agree with each other on everything, and as Lionel, Daniel and I discussed in our last episode, we would also challenge some of the points made. We are coming from a different place, after all, being reporters rather than scientists. But I hope you'll agree that this kind of discussion and debate in this kind of forum can be quite constructive. I'm sure we will do it again at some point, hopefully with Jeroen and Ross involved again. Of course, it's an ongoing discussion, and we'll be talking about this subject forever, including in our forthcoming Friends special, our first of 2016, Inside the Lab with Chris Froome. But we will be moving on to other topics as well. Our second Friends special in February will look back at the demise of the HTC High Road team, with exclusive new interviews with some of the key people, including Bob Stapleton, Rolf Aldag, Brian Holm, Bernard Eisel, Mark Cavendish, many of whom will of course be reunited in 2016 at Team Dimension Data. This, I promise, will be a fascinating episode, and we like to think it alone will be worth the year's subscription. You can become a friend of the podcast. It's £10 for 2016, and that will give you 11 exclusive Friends specials. And finally, they will be available on your mobile device. Apologies for the delay with that, but finally, that is up and running. See www.thecyclingpodcast.com for details. In the next week or so, we will release a final regular podcast of 2015, an end-of-year special, with some of our regular contributors, including Ned Bolting, Rob Hatch, Orla Shinawi, and the legend that is Ciro Scognamiglio. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks for your support, and have a very Merry Christmas.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.